This episode of Breaking Brave is brought to you by Crank Coffee, the newest member of the Neal Brothers family. Crank Coffee is a new Canadian whole bean coffee brand that is certified organic and fair trade, founded by the Neal Brothers, Peter and Chris. This brand was influenced by cycling, coffee lovers, and experts. Check it out at the Neal Brothers online shop and use our coupon code BRAVE for 20% off your first Crank Coffee purchase. Enjoy. And I wanted to mention that if you would like to connect with me directly, you can always do so at marilynbarefoot.com or breakingbrave.show. I see and answer every single contact personally, and I would truly love to hear from you. Welcome to Breaking Brave. I'm Marilyn Barefoot, your host. I had never heard of the word philanthrotainment until meeting today's guest, Lane. Lane is an advocate for social impact. Their work as the Auctionista has raised over $40 million for charity. They champion the idea that no challenge is insurmountable and no dream is unattainable. Lane is one of the most coveted and respected auctioneers and keynote speakers in the fundraising space, with a fabulous reputation for personal storytelling that really connects. Please welcome the passionate, authentic catalyst for positive change, the very brave, Lane. I am so very excited about this chat today. I am chatting with Lane. The research before chatting with Lane today has taught me a ton. So the first thing I'm going to ask you, Lane, please tell me and the whole world, what are your pronouns?
My pronouns are they, them, and thank you for asking. What are your pronouns, Marilyn?
She, her. We'll jump from there because you can introduce yourself way better than I can introduce you. So please just hit it and then we'll just start chatting.
My name is Lane the Auctionista. My pronouns are they, them. I am a keynote speaker, a fundraising auctioneer, and also provide training in DEIB. I've been Lane the Auctionista for almost 15 years. I've done probably 1,500 events I've performed at in various capacities as show host, as a fundraising host. I've raised over $40 million for charity over that period of time. I'm passionate about humanity, philanthropy, and moving the dial on creating a very inclusive, accepting, and a world of belonging, and doing that with kindness and comedy, because if it's not fun, Lane doesn't do it.
I think that's why I loved you from the moment we met. In all of the video that I watched, how would anybody not want you at a keynote speech or a fundraising event? So, Lane, I would love to start with your story, because I've read about this, your coming out story. Would you be kind enough to share that with the world?
Of course I will. My coming out story took me a long time to get to. I was age 42, and I had been hiding my truth for all of those years. I'm okay to share that it was probably at the age of 6 or 7 that I looked at myself in the mirror. I was standing in the bathroom, looking at myself. I had my dad's shaving cream on and his Brill cream through my hair, and looking at myself, thinking, "You're not dead name, you're Gary, Bob, whatever," and thinking, what is wrong with me? Why am I feeling this way? What's wrong with me? So I've always thought that I was very different than everybody else. And of course, through the formative years of the teen years, I just kept it in. We didn't talk about that stuff back in the 70s. Maybe you did if you were in a hippie in California, but certainly where I grew up, you know, being gay or a homosexual, that was the word, was that was not discussed. So I hit it. And, you know, got married, had a couple of kids, continued to hide it. Marriage ended, and I just figured I'd be alone. So fortunately, I'm not alone, and I did find the love of my life. I met Sue when I was 40 years old, and, you know, we started a relationship, and I hid it from my family. My mom passed away at age 62, and this is the weird thing. This is the year that I turned 62. So my mom passed away at 62 from ovarian cancer, and I was with Sue at that time. So, you know, my father, my sister, my brother, and I, we gathered at my parents' place, and my sister knew that I had this friend, Sue. My brother-in-law knew, and they said, you know, don't you think Sue should be here? And I'm like, what do you mean Sue should be here? She's just a friend. She a friend. We're friends. We hang out. And my sister said, you know, let me go talk to Daddy. And I said, okay. And of course, you never want to be outed by somebody else, but I had said, okay. So she came out from the den and she said, Daddy wants to talk to you. And I'm like, okay. Great. This is it. This is the moment. And I walked into the den and my dad was sitting there and he said, I am so disappointed. And I thought, oh my gosh, here we go. And the next words that came out of his mouth were, Mommy and I love you. This changes nothing. Nothing. And I'm so disappointed that you didn't feel that you could come to us sooner and share this. And so, by the way, get on the phone and call Sue, and she needs to be here. She is part of our family. And that is how it happened. And it couldn't have been a more perfect situation. And to know that I was loved by my family was the foundation to allow me to start being myself freely beyond the walls of the family. And then I trotted down the hallway to my sister and said, how did you even figure it out? She's like, Lane, I've known you all my life. I've known since you were a kid, but you just never told me. So, you know, there it was. It was as simple as that. I started then kind of sharing beyond my family, and I lost friends along the way. And you know what? That's okay. If they couldn't accept me for who I was, then really, how can we really be friends?
Thank you so much for sharing that, Lane. So I'm very sorry for your loss of your mom.
Thank you.
Because 62, that's really young to be taken down by that big C word.
It is. But my life has been spared and saved because of my mom's situation, because I cannot even still believe it to this day. But after my mom passed away, her surgeon continued to call my father on a regular basis saying, your daughters need to be tested. They need to be tested. They should be tested. Genetic testing. I was in a flurry of love. I was springing into this lesbian world, newly found love. And I was like flitting through the daffodils, you know, through the meadow, like, you know, like the Sound of Music. I was Maria. I was Maria, spinning around. My head was in the clouds. I was in love. And I just kept putting it off. And my father really pushed to have my sister and I have the genetic testing. Back in those days, it was blood that was taken, blood sample, and you waited 6 months. You waited 6 months for results. And we got the results. And my sister did not carry the BRCA gene. But I did.
Okay, so what does that mean? First of all, I don't even know what a BRCA gene is. And if you don't remember all those fancy names that each of those letters stands for, don't worry about it. But I didn't know that that was how they would figure it out. I didn't know.
Yeah, that's how they figure it out. So the chances of me having breast cancer were extremely high because I carried this gene. They look at the familial structure of who, you know, on maternal, paternal side has had breast and ovarian because they are directly connected.
Yeah.
And so my mother's side was just filled with little black dots, all of the aunts and things. Wow. So there was a very high chance that, you know, my sister and I would carry this gene. She was fine, but not me. And so, and my level for chances of ovarian were extremely high. So I, at 42, I made an immediate, you know, I said, look, my breasts have done what they've had to do. Yes. They've fed the babies. They've done the things. And you know what? Now I'm good. So I had a double mastectomy at age 42. And 30 days later, of course, because it's Lane, I just got to get stuff done because I got to get it off the list. It's on the list. And I had a full hysterectomy a month later. So that's what I did. And obviously that reduced my chances for cancer, breast, ovarian, like just put me in the regular, you know, percentage. I want to say very interestingly enough how women's health has progressed. One of my incredibly dear clients is Women's College Hospital. And I fundraise for them every single year. Just this past March, like 3 weeks ago, you know, we helped them raise $500,000 in less than 10 minutes. But what is so profound about them is they are the leaders in women's health research. And they, in their research, have developed a saliva kit, Marilyn, to test for BRCA1. So 20 years ago, I waited 6 months in agony, waiting for results. And now, because of research, because of all the people that donate and give and fund that research hospital, there is now a saliva kit. So that was my journey. And so all this was happening at the same time. You know, I was like dancing in the meadows, happy in this new relationship, and this incredible loss of my mother. Also that emotional, there is an emotional loss too with having one's breasts removed because we've lived with them. They're part of our identity. They're part of our body. There was a lot of emotion that came along with that for me at that time. So it was, and also Sue was not out at work. And so this was the other thing is that I was going to be recovering at home for a week. And she said like, I've never told anybody that I have a female partner. So that was a moment, a profound moment where she had to share that she needed to be off work for a week to feed me egg salad and to get me to the bathroom and to do all the things for me. And she had to come out at work. So it was a profound time for both of us.
Wow. Let me tell you why I asked just the lead question that got us there, which is phenomenal, about people being checked in your family. Is because I'm a breast cancer survivor, and it was my daughter who's now 30 years old. I say that because the birthday is on its way, so she's likely going to be 31 in August, and said, Mom, you know what this means. We need to have everybody around, like, looked into. But you know what, Lean? When I was growing up, for some reason, that just wasn't talked about. You know, somebody in my family died of cancer, but what kind of cancer? Nobody really bothered to check, look into, discuss, or figure out that it might run in the family. So thankfully, thank God you said what you said, because Women's College Hospital is astounding. I love them. And so thank you for all the great work you're doing with them. They are magnificent. If there is this kind or any kind of cancer in your family, you talk about black dots. I couldn't even, you know, get to the right people to ask the right questions about, okay, grandma died of cancer. What kind? Turned out it was breast.
Yeah. So, of course, I have two daughters. They both have the gene as well.
Oh, so what does life look like for them in terms of getting a test or a saliva test or any of these things?
Oh, they've had the test. They've had the genetic testing. That's how we know they both carry the BRCA1. And they are both under, well, they are now 33 and almost 31. And so they are already on their, you know, on oncological journey, they are getting regular breast screening, and they will have decisions to be made because my mother's mother, my maternal grandmother, died in a refugee camp at age 36 from breast cancer. So my mother was motherless at the age of 9. So the youngest person in our family, a female family history, was 36. And that is why there was such a sense of urgency for me to make a decision, because at that time I was 42. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so my daughters need to make decisions as well. And so they are already doing the checking, going regularly under supervision. So this is the great thing about talking about it, right? Because it saves lives. And, you know, and we know you talk about, you know, not talking about family history. One of the other big taboos, we don't talk about finance at home. Nobody teaches us about, you know, this is what a mortgage is and this is what happens when you do. Or we don't talk about being gay. Like, you know, there's so many taboo subjects. And if we just let it go, just like the Frozen song, let it go, let it go, just let it go and talk about it and normalize, take the stigma away from, there's so many topics. I mean, we can go down a big, big old rabbit hole right now, but just let that stuff go and just start talking about sex and contraception and finance and you know, all of this stuff. Wouldn't we just be all better off if we just, who do our kids trust? It's the parents that will always be there for them, always lift them up, always hold them up, giving them the right answers, hugging them when they're broken and scared and unwell, and lifting them up to help them succeed. We're the ones that they should be coming to talk to. Yes. Not between the ages of 14 and 18, because they hate us, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's
right.
It's okay. We accept that.
Yeah, we accept that.
Oh, Lane, this is going in so many incredible directions. And finance, it's funny how those two, when I was growing up, were the two taboos, sex and finance.
Yep.
And you have to figure it out on your own, or you have to learn about it on the street, or
on the back of the Tampax box. I don't know if you remember that, but it's like there was a diagram on how to insert the Tampax. Lay on the floor, put your body at a 47.5 degree angle, lift your leg, cross it over, and insert. Come on. Do you not? You're laughing hard right now because you damn well remember that.
I totally remember that. And it was like a game of Twister.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh, my God. And the tears rolling down. And it's like, oh, my God, that can't possibly be right. What I've just done.
And is it supposed to feel like that?
Is it supposed to feel like that? Oh, wow. Look at this little rabbit hole.
That's a lovely rabbit hole. And I can tell you for sure that we have never talked about the inserting process of tampons on any Breaking Brave, but I love that we're having these quote unquote brave conversations.
Yeah.
And my daughter had her first period, came at school. I said to her, when this happens to you, I want you to call me because we're going to celebrate, because it's not a taboo thing. It's a celebration. So the school called me and said, she's lying down and why don't you come get her? And we went and got a bag of chips and a big thing of dip, and we put on a girly movie, and we had a heating pad, and we spent the afternoon together. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, Lane, so we're going to talk about the next story of how did you go from being a financial advisor to now being only one of three Canadian benefit auctioneer specialists. You've already mentioned the number. You've raised over $40 million for charity. And you have coined a phrase which is uniquely yours called philanthrotainment. This is all the big ball of the auctionista. So maybe tell our audience how you went from financial advisor to now doing what you're doing.
Completely by mistake. You know, when I have a keynote that's called Bidding to Be Your Best. And I talk about my, you know, entrepreneurial journey and going to auction school. And I start off the keynote by saying, how many of you fell into your career? And I will see many, many hands up, many hands up. But then I say, how many of you fell into your career because somebody said you can't do it? That's exactly what happened to me. Sue and I attended my first charity dinner auction gala. I was maybe 44 at the time, 45, in around that. And I had never been to a gala. I grew up, you know, in a multi-generational home with my grandparents, my parents who had come from another country. I'm first generation Canadian kid, bullied throughout my childhood for looking different, having different food, having a grandfather that didn't speak English, wearing homemade clothes, all of that kind of stuff. And even as I grew into my adult life, I never was connected with the charitable sector at all. Anything that was done in a charitable format was done in a church basement or a social club or whatever. So this was all brand new to me. And I literally didn't understand what was going to happen that night. I said, what do we do? Do we bring a wallet? Do we bring money? Like, how does this work? And we walk in and, you know, I know that what I saw was a silent auction, all like the fugly Afghans and, you know, oil and vinegar baskets and, you know, posters and toasters and bicycles and all this kind of stuff. That's fine. We sit down, we have our chicken dinner, and then he takes the stage. So I did not know anything about auctioneers. I know now that that person was likely a livestock auctioneer because he approached the podium. And very stereotypical, what most people think of an auctioneer, you know, the vinyl pocket liner, 16 or 18 pens in there, you know, glasses at the end of the nose. And he just starts. 2 hours of live auction, 120 items, just like little pigs, piglets. And next we got a bicycle. Hey, I know. And then berating the crowd. I know you make money. So come on, let's get this going. 2 hours. 2 hours. It was, you know, the Flintstones. Did you ever watch the Flintstones? And you know, when they're running through the house, it's like table, lamp, chair, table, lamp, chair. It's like the same scene over and over. This was what he did for 2 hours. Table, lamp, chair, table, lamp, chair, table, lamp, chair, table, lamp, chair. You see what I'm talking about? I turned to Sue and I said to her, my gosh, I could do this so much better. Here we are supporting this charity. We're very close friends with the executive director. We're supposed to be feeling inspired to give. We're supposed to be feeling inspired about, you know, raising money. And meanwhile, all I'm feeling is jarred and perplexed and a little bit offended.
Yeah.
And uncomfortable. So after the end of the live auction, I walked up to Buddy and I said, how would I learn to do what you do? And no, this is the absolute, absolute truth. He looked me up and down. And he said these 8 words that have stuck in my brain for almost 20 years now. Hey, little missy, number one. We can unpack those 3 words for 2 hours. Hey, little missy, this is a generational career. All I heard is closed club,
yeah.
You're not welcome. Gender discrimination. And the other thing is you can't do this because my father was a pharmacist who shook a mean martini. And so, you know, there was no way that I would ever. But what I heard in my brain, it was like the kerosene to a match.
Yeah.
Nobody puts Lane in the corner. Nobody puts baby in the corner. So I went home and I was obsessed with this for months. And I did my research and I decided that I was going to go to auction school. And the auction school that I selected was in Mason City, Iowa, in the Midwest. And the story continues from there. And I went for a week at auction school. I came back and I had no market, no business development, no idea what I was doing. There was nobody doing what I wanted to do in Canada. And nobody talked. If there was somebody doing charity auctions, they're like, well, you're just going to have to figure it out. We don't talk about our pricing. We don't talk about. So I just started figuring it out.
Iowa. I bet that went well.
Well, you know, I arrived late at night and there was a welcoming reception and I walked in and there they were. Those generational boys, 10-gallon hats, big silver belt buckles. And I knew in that moment, I was the only gay in the village. And I ran up to my hotel room. I got on that old landline thing. And I called Sue and I said, you know what? I've made a massive mistake. I'm coming home. I'm coming. This is it. No. I am not putting myself. And she, thank God, God love her. She said, you are not coming home. I'm locking the doors. You're not coming home. You, Lane, have been talking in my ear about this for 6 months, all day, all night. You're staying. And I did stay. And I completed the week. And I will say to you that I have never felt such vulnerability in my life. I was so overwhelmed. I was so feeling so vulnerable because these were kids that were generational auctioneers, Ma and Pa and Uncle and Grandpa. And I couldn't talk fast. I don't talk fast to this day. Yeah. People think I talk fast. I don't talk fast. And I realized at the end of the day, I got through it. And I always quote Brené Brown because Brené Brown's quote, vulnerability is the greatest measure of courage. I did it. I got through. Some of those boys even became my friends. And it was a wild experience. And that's how that went. I was the clean-cut, card-carrying lesbian, just so stereotypical, you know, clean-cut, you know, the certain, you know, chino pants that some of us wear and, you know, the penny loafers and all that. That, and it's like, wow, what a different world this is.
Do they give you like a graduation certificate or do you come away with like a degree as an auctioneer or what is it that you walk away with other than total vulnerability?
Yeah, you're going to love this. Yes, they give you a certificate. I also received a certificate for being a bilingual auctioneer because I learned how to auction in Spanish, which I've never used in my career, but that's okay. But the other thing that you receive is kind of like a knighthood. You are then, after you complete auction school, you can actually prefix your name with Colonel. It's the truth. And I never adopted that.
I have to start calling you Colonel.
Yeah, well, I do. There is one instance when I was called Colonel. When I turned 50, my friends and my wife had a massive big birthday party at a bar, which had a big marquee outside. And it said, Happy 50th, Colonel Lane. So I've never adopted that. But yes, you may use the word Colonel as an official title of an auctioneer.
Thank you for that story. Now, so now you're back and you don't want to do it like little piggy auctions. You want to do charity auctions. You need a market. You need a platform. You need to start your business. How did you do that?
In this period of time, I decided I did not want to be a financial advisor anymore. We had a tragic, traumatic event happen in our family. And I reached out to the Sexual Assault Center London for support, got involved with them as a board member, and basically said, okay, now I'm this auctioneer. Let me help you rebrand into a gala. You know, they were just doing very small, very grassroots fundraising. And I said, I'll host the show. And I'll be the auctioneer. And so that was one of the first. And then it just spread word of mouth. I remember the very, very first auction that I did prior to this one through a friend of mine. I just decimated it. I got confused with my numbers. I was selling at the wrong price. I was like very, very confused. It did not go well, but I persevered because I knew this is what I wanted to do. And then I had changed careers. I was now the director of development at a charity in London. So I was doing that as my full-time gig and then working on building my business, which has really, I've never done marketing. It has all built word of mouth. So, you know, when you're in a room of 300 to 500 to 700 people, there's typically somebody that's going to be like, wow, we need them for our event. And it just
goes from there.
So I got to the point in my career where I was juggling two full-time things. I was full-time at this charity working 9 to 5. And then after work, I was working on building the business, right? I was doing the gigs. I was doing the contracts, cleaning the toilets, talking to customers, building all that. And then eventually I came to this fulcrum point in my career where it's like, okay, I think it's time that if I, you know, leave this 9 to 5, which I was happy to do because I'm really not a 9 to 5 person, never really have been. I know that about myself. So anyways, I left that and the rest is history. Once I was able to give 100% focus to the Auctionista business, it completely exploded.
When I watch the videos of you and the work that you do, I can feel the passion, the energy just coming out of you that you're meant for this. This is your calling. That's what it feels like to me. So I've got to believe that, of course, you're not going to adjust your energy level or commitment level based on how much you're being asked to raise or how many people are in the room, right?
That's correct. The bottom line for me is that I am incredibly passionate about raising money. I am incredibly passionate about philanthropy. 1,500 events, I have seen such transformation in people's lives. I meet the most vulnerable and marginalized folks that you can imagine. And because of the charity providing services and supports, how their lives have been affected and impacted and how they've grown and have been given the opportunity. There is nothing more powerful than we can do as human beings for each other than to share our time and our resources to lift people up, to help people grow and reach their full potential. I live and breathe by that. I also, when I put my silver shoes on and I have a whole green room process, as soon as I arrive in my green room, I have my silver shoes packed in special shoe bags, one for each, and I put them out immediately. And I already feel the power. It's like my superpower. Then I get dressed. I put my tuxedo jacket on, my headpiece, my earpiece, and I literally feel a physical and emotional, a visceral transformation. I feel excited, empowered. I can't wait to entertain people. I can't wait to make them feel good. And I can't wait to crush goals because honestly, failure is not an option for in Lane's world. So I have such deep respect for frontline workers at these charities, the work that they do. They work on a small budget, Marilyn. It's unbelievable what can be accomplished.
God bless you for what you're doing. Let's do a call out to how can people find you, connect with you, follow you, hire you? And we're going to get into your speaking events as well as what you're doing for charitable auctions.
There's only one Lane and it's Lane the Auctionista. And you just have to Google her and get in that Googler and I'm everywhere. Website auctionista.ca, Instagram, LinkedIn. There's only one Lane, LAYNE, Auctionista. Yeah.
Here's the signature question. What does bravery mean to you, Lane?
Well, I think bravery means to me is always staying true to yourself. don't allow people to mislabel you, pigeonhole you. Stay true. I think that is a very, very important thing. And sometimes that's not easy. And in my career as a non-binary performer, I'm going to tell you, the discrimination that I have experienced and still do experience a lot. So that's bravery.
Yes, God bless you, it is. And you're living it every day, obviously. Can I ask for a story or an indication or when you say you experience this discrimination? I mean, I don't want to name names or anything, but I want the world to understand, and the best way for the world to understand is through processing it as a story. So could you?
Absolutely. And I am very open about this, and I do not name names because it's not necessary. There's no reason. That's just inappropriate curiosity for some people. And yeah. So... and I do talk about this in my keynotes in our DEIB workshop as well. The one instance that is very blatant, I was in the middle of a live auction and I was selling an item between two people back and forth and back and forth. And I'm very interactive. Like, I'm not on stage. I'm down there. I'm like kissing babies' heads, holding, you know, just high-fiving. And in the middle of an auction, and when I went up to this individual, and I said, are you going to go 1500? Are you going to go? You're going to go? He stops and he says, are you a man or a woman?
What did you say?
Doesn't matter. And I carried on. So these microaggressions, and I talk about this a lot because it's traumatic. Microaggressions are, it's, you know, oh, it was unintentional. Oh, you know, I was just curious. It's subtle. But when you're on the receiving end of microaggression after microaggression after microaggression, then you start internalizing that as trauma. And that trauma has led me, and it has accumulated, and I'm pretty thick-skinned, but I'm human as well. And, you know, that has led me at times in my career to feel that imposter syndrome, taking me back to that seven-year-old. What is wrong with you? Are you actually as good as people say you are? Are you a good performer? So that's one example. And misgendering, I did an event, and we're very, very clear on what my pronouns are. I am in a fortunate position as a performer to have a media kit that is provided to each client so that my official bio is in there with the correct pronouns, so that MCs in their script know how to, you know, introduce me. So I did an event in a community where the chief of police was the MC.
Okay.
And I'm standing side stage because he's introducing me. Mm-hmm. And I hear the official bio. And I know the official bio. I know the words. But what he did is he changed out my pronouns to she. Lena's. Not they. She. So then I have to analyze. So some people have said, is that because that's a political statement? I don't know. I will not answer for him. Could it be his discomfort, his lack of education around pronouns? And how dare you just decide on your own accord to just switch that out?
Yeah.
I can go on and on. And, you know, it happens. Every month I will have stories of discrimination. And this is why it's important at this point in my career. I kind of look at this, I'm in my third act, I'm 61. But kind of when you get to 60, it's like, you know what? I pretty much can say anything I wanted to say now and do what I want to do. Of course, my wife says, how is that any different than the day before you turned 60? but, you know, now in this third act of my career, you know, I've had 15 years of stage performance experience. I've had 15 years of inspiring people to take action and to make change, right? Through my fundraising narrative and how I represent my charities. Now it's time for me to take that voice beyond the ballroom and do something that's really personal. And that is to educate folks about gender identity as part of their DEIB scope and strategy, overall strategy for their corporation organization, and to be that person that is visible, to be that 60-year-old where a young queer person sees Lane on stage, successful entrepreneur, comfortable in their skin, very much, you know, authentically non-binary, this is who I am, courage, all of those things that folks describe me as. And I want to continue being that trailblazer. I broke the mold of a stereotypical auctioneer.
You sure did.
And I did it successfully. And so I know that I can move people. And I know that folks will learn something when Lane speaks, because I have, you know, in my DEIB training, sure, we're doing, you know, the training piece and the glossary of terms and what is gender identity, what is sexual orientation. But I also include my own personal storytelling that aligns with the content, because then that makes it really real for people, right? And my keynotes also, you know, not every keynote is around coming out and being non-binary and discrimination, but, you know, it's around mental health, how to overcome adversity. You know, when COVID hit Maryland, my business went dark.
Yeah.
Sue lost her job.
Oh, no.
And the one thing we were looking forward to was we had a grandbaby arriving in July. Thankfully, we got to hold him on July the 11th, because on July 23rd, he passed away. So we had cumulative trauma, financial trauma, emotional trauma, grief. And, you know, I had to completely pivot my business to virtual and, you know, and successfully did that. So, you know, these are the things that we all experience. It, you know, every one of us human beings, we have traumas that we have lived through. But how do you move through and grow? I don't, you know, resilience. Okay. Oh, you know, everybody likes to use that word. But for me, I kind of look at it as, you know, those deep valleys that we are in. We will climb out of them. We will go through a growth and a learning experience, and we will come out with new perspectives and new strength and maybe courage that we didn't know that we had.
Yeah.
I'm also a survivor of domestic violence as well. So there's a lot.
There's a lot. There is so much, Lane.
Yeah, there's a lot. But, you know, I live my life through the lens of my 4-year-old self. There is something very beautiful about being 4 years old, in my opinion. You know, so free. Are you kidding me? Mommy comes into your bedroom in the morning and you're hanging off your bed or your crib or whatever. And you're like, pick me up. It's a new day.
Yeah.
It's a new day.
Yeah.
I'm going to ride my bike. I'm going to do all the fun things. I have made choices in my career. I don't do the things I don't want to do. I don't work 9 to 5. I've created this world where I work my hours and they're flexible. I don't work for someone. I work for myself. I do something that is so naturally sits inside who I am as a person. And I mean, I have had previous careers, but, you know, we are fluid individuals. And, you know, my interests at 25, you know, wanting to go into marketing, my interests are very different now. So, you know, play is so important for not just children's emotional, psychological, social development. We need to do that as adults, because it wards off depression. It keeps us connected to social situations and connections. It also sends all those beautiful chemicals through our body. Somebody said to me, Lane, I'm going to rename you Lemonade Lane. I said, what do you mean Lemonade Lane? I was in the green room for Women's College, and I was speaking to an
Oh, anesthetist. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But they are like the doctor of all doctors of anesthetists, right? And in pain management. And she watched me do what I do. And she said, do you realize that you have learned how to access your internal pharmacy? I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. Explain. You're Lemonade Lane. Most people need, you know, many people need alcohol, drugs, prescription drugs to produce the endorphins.
Yeah.
Right? You are creating your own endogenous opioids, Lane, by doing this work that you are so passionate about. Your body is filled with endorphins and all that great stuff. And that's what makes you feel good.
Naturally, without the help of any other prompt.
Right.
Right.
So when you do something that you love so much, first of all, it doesn't feel like work. And second of all, it gives you a thrill and it gives you that happy feeling, which many people don't feel they have. And, you know, we have 160 hours in a week and we sleep for 50 of those. And another 40 of those are spent in a job doing maybe something that you don't like with maybe some colleagues that are not, you know, your thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, then that only leaves a certain period of time left in your week. What are you going to do with it? Well, I got to go grocery shopping. I got to run the kids around to soccer, basketball, and ballet. And then how much time does that leave for you to like access your internal pharmacy? I do it 80 hours a week doing the work that I do. I am joyous right now chatting with you. I feel very happy. I'm sure you can see that in my demeanor.
I can see it and I can feel it. Yeah. And the wonderful thing is I think it also helps me and probably anybody listening to this to feel that too. It's very contagious. That energy, that love, that passion, that sincerity, it's very contagious. And you wonder, that's a tremendous, tremendous quote of, you have learned how to access your internal pharmacy. How much the world needs to do that, figure out ways to do that, because they wouldn't get as sick. There wouldn't be as much disease, depression, mental health issues. If people, I mean, yeah, maybe you have to do this 9-to-5 job because you have to pay the bills, blah, blah, blah. But there's got to be a special point in every day that you set out, you carve out, even if it's 20 minutes to 30 minutes, that's joyful just for you. I truly believe.
I believe that too. I really do. I'm incredibly grateful for the life that I have been. It didn't feel this way before I became the auctionista. I will be honest with you. It wasn't always, I didn't always feel like this, but
no,
you know, carving my own path, doing it my way, being authentically myself, it's been blissful.
And the climb out of the valley, I truly believe is what makes it as blissful as it is. Because if you didn't know the lowest of the lows, then you can't experience the highest of the highs, at least in my experience, that, you know, if you're just a flatline life for your whole life, then there are no lows and highs and you don't know what this passion and this happiness level can be.
Yeah, I agree with that. And there's not one human amongst us that hasn't had the lowest of lows. I mean, you know, the greatest thing that I've learned along the way is that when we are open and we speak our truth, that really lets other folks know that they are not alone in this journey. You know, when I speak on International Women's Day about my experience with intimate partner violence, if one person in that room responds and says, oh, wow, that's my story, I can get beyond this too. Now I know what I should do and for my next steps, you know. It's a tough thing. You know, I'm going to kind of bring this around, switch the tone to something a little more humorous, because that's kind of the situation that Sue and I were in when we first got together. This was like our first same-sex relationship for for both of us.
For each of you.
And we're, for each of us. And, you know, we're Maria in the meadow. We're spinning and spinning and spinning. But as Maria in the meadow, you see nothing around you, right? It's this right. meadow. It's these mountains. There are no other people. And, you know, finding community is incredibly important, right? Finding community. So I said, well, okay, there's the two of us. I said, we should probably see if there's other lesbians. At that time, I identified as a lesbian. We should find out if there's other lesbians around. And we looked at each other and we said, well, how are we going to do that? And I said, ha ha, we're going to Google it. And literally, no word of a lie, where are all the lesbians? Where do they go? And do you know what popped up? The London Lesbian Film Festival in London, Ontario. That's where they all go. And that first year when we were together, we trekked out to London. We bought tickets for the weekend. And we were like, wow, look at them all. Look at them all. All different shapes, sizes, outwardly, you know, appearances. It's like, it was lesbian Christmas. It's like, what? And we found community. And that is so important for people to understand that they are not alone on this island. And that is has a ripple effect to the keynote topics I speak about, to the life experiences I share. Because you know what? I look out at an audience. I don't know who is going through what at what moment in their life. I don't know who's queer. I don't know who's non-binary. I don't know who's cisgendered. I cannot assume any of that. So when I speak my truth, I know that I'm touching somebody out there that's going to be like, wow, Lane's had that experience. I know I'm not alone.
And look at her. Look at them. Excuse me.
Yes, I was going to say, look at who, her.
Yeah, no, I just made that mistake. And that's my age speaking. Look at them. My apologies, Lane. Look at them, says somebody or several people in the audience. They are strong. They are happy. They are passionate about what they're doing. They're raising money for all of these amazing causes as the Auctionista. That gives people so much hope. You are an incredible gift to this world, Lane.
That's really kind of you. I appreciate that.
Thank you for joining me today and for teaching me so much and teaching the world so much and being so open and honest and vulnerable. And I hope that we have touched some people today by this conversation.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for creating a safe space for me to share openly. I appreciate that from you.
Thank you so much for listening. For updates between episodes, I'd encourage you to join my mailing list, which you can do at either marilynbarefoot.com or breakingbrave.show. At most once a month, at least once a quarter, you'll receive an update on the latest resources, topics, and information I've found either super helpful or amazingly impactful. That's it for now. See you next time.